We all love music. We all love different music. And our relationship with music is often intense, and our individual musical taste is intensely personal and deeply felt. Nolan Gasser, critically acclaimed composer and pianist, musicologist, and the chief architect of Pandora Radio's celebrated Music Genome Project, takes on the daunting task of describing the sources and nature of musical taste and explaining not just what music is, but why it matters to us in his new book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. It's a great pleasure to welcome Nolan Gasser to the roundtable this morning. Nolan, thank you very much for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
This is a big book. It is a big subject. What led you to it initially?
Well, I'm very fortunate. I've been an active musician my entire life. I started playing piano when I was 4, and I have a PhD in Renaissance musicology from Stanford, and it was at the end of my studies there, this was back in 2000, that I got an email from a fellow named Tim Westergren, who just a couple of months earlier had gotten some seed money for a startup music technology company that today is Pandora Radio. So I'm the architect of the Music Genome Project that runs Pandora. And obviously, it was an amazing journey to get there. And given that success, I've obviously thought a lot about musical taste, and so had the opportunity to dive even further. What we did at Pandora was really to dive under the hood of the music itself to figure out what's going on musically that can drive people toward or away from certain music. And I wanted to answer that bigger question: where does our taste for music come from in the first place? And this was a real chance to do that.
You make the point, and it is, when you think of the ingredients that make up the answer to that question of why you like it, you are talking about history and theory and aesthetics and science and culture and psychology and mathematics and physics and neuroscience and biology, dot, 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 dot. There is a lot there. So how do you even begin to distill that?
Well, you know, I liken the book a bit to a mystery novel. The question is, where does our taste for music come from? Collectively and then individually, what is it at the end of the day that makes, you know, our individual taste is sort of, you know, different from our spouse or from our brothers and sisters and even close friends? And so, in order to tell that story, I really wanted to have that sort of 360-degree look at music and all the ways that music relates to the universe, to our lives, to our upbringing. So I start with notions of evolution and the physics of sound, and obviously that does require getting a little bit into the maths and mathematics and all that, but it's a fascinating tale because all of those things have influenced throughout the centuries the way the music is actually made. But then as we dive into our culture, the culture that we grow up in, if we grow up in the West, those scales, those rhythms, those meters, those kinds of harmonies, we take them for granted. But this is our language. It's different than if we grew up in India or in China. And then as we could dive even further into our individual lives, where we grow up, the kinds of economic and, you know, and religious and cultural sort of environments, those subcultures, those provide a tremendous force in sort of fine-tuning our taste. They give us access to some music, but not so much to others. And then finally, it is our psychology, our individual personalities, our sort of the way that we sort of interpret emotion, the way that we experience the world, those individual ways at the end of the day will say why we love one Beatles song more than another, whereas our best friend might have the opposite view. Mm. So it's a complex tale, but I really try to make it as a singular sort of story for all of us to understand where our taste comes from and what we can do about it, how we can use our love for music, which we all have, to make our lives better.
When we're talking about our best friend or our brother or sister who, of why we may like one Beatles tune as opposed to another, and they may have a different feeling, when you write about the ear and the brain and how they process music, is that universal? Does that formula happen the same way in each of us, or is it different for each individual?
Well, it is both. You know, again, we all come hardwired to love music. I do have a full, you know, interlude on music in the brain. It's a fascinating topic. It's obviously kind of a hot one these days. And the research that has been done over the last 20 years really gives us a lot of insight into really how, you know, amazing our brain is at perceiving, at processing, at making sense of music. Our ear as well, as you rightly note. Every single pitch that we hear, if we're hearing a full, you know, rock band or a full symphony orchestra, then the number of frequencies, the actual pitches and the overtones that are happening all at once is astounding. It's a tremendous number with all different, you know, sound properties. Our brains can figure that out, not just to say that's a trombone and that's a saxophone, but to actually be able to make sense of it, you know, as meaning and emotion. So we all come hardwired with that tremendous ability. We all have the ability to lock into a steady beat. It's called entrainment, and I talk about it a fair bit in the book because it's sort of a miracle, and we're unique among species that we can hear a beat, dum bum ba dum bum 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 bum, and we take it for granted that we can follow that beat and tap along. If I sang it faster or slower, we'd be able to do the same. But other animals can't do that, and that actual property, I think, lays at the groundwork for our love for music, the way that music is so important in all of our, in every culture across the world. So on and on and on, these are ways in which we all share a certain musical capacity. But then as we sort of dive further into our individuality, by the time that we're 1 year old, for example, our brains have been encultured. They've been fine-tuned, just as we can, you know, when we're born, we can literally make any sound of any language. But within that first year and first couple of years, that becomes more limited. We speak English or Japanese or whatever it is. Well, similarly, we begin to hear in our culture those scales that we hear in our everyday lives. Those become that normal way in which music sort of proceeds, as opposed to other cultures and other scales. So, again, all that's to say that it is both something that we all share in common, but as we grow older, we all become more and more individual.
One of the questions I had as I was reading the book, and I thought it's specific, and yet it gets to something of how many variables there can be. I know as a radio host, I often get the opportunity to be in a studio when people are performing live, and right. They perform live in a studio, and I'm sitting there, and I'm just a few feet from the stage, and it sounds amazing, and I'm just like, man, this is incredible. And then we play the tape back the next day, and you're like, oh. Really?
Maybe it wasn't so.
Yeah.
So hot.
Well, what happens? I mean, I just because is that within the recording or is that within just the way we then process it?
Well, I mean, obviously there could be a lot of factors going
sure.
on there. It could have been maybe that it wasn't recorded as well as it could have been. But you know, I think that what it does speak to is that way that music is a social phenomenon, that when we are in the process of, especially when we're live with other musicians, you know, we have something called mirror neurons in our brain, so that if a musician is, you know, feeling very passionately and maybe they're just feeling all kinds of joy or intensity or even sadness or even anger, we actually respond to that emotionally through the sound. So I think emotionally we're caught up in that social bonding that music can do, where we become part of a collective. And the way, like, if that person on stage were speaking, there would be certain barriers that we might put up because then we're interpreting things in a very specific way. But music communicates on an emotional level and in a more abstract way. And so we don't have those opportunities to misunderstand one another. So, I mean, there's a lot of that that goes on. That's why that when we're at a church service or at a baseball game and we're all hearing that same piece of music, we feel this collective bond. It's a root of culture in a large way. And so that what could have happened is that you were caught up in that communicative social moment that was even beyond just the sound of the rhythms and the notes and the harmonies.
Right.
And when you just heard it, you know, on your headphones or whatever the next day, it lacked that kind of sort of social, and maybe it didn't have the same sort of impact on you. But sometimes it's the opposite. You know, sometimes you can hear things in a solitary way, and they can have an even more profound impact on you.
Nolan Gasser is the author of Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. The book is published by Flatiron. When it comes to music, and you write quite a bit about this, emotion plays such a role. I mean, we can also like it today and not like it tomorrow or vice versa, right?
Of course. When we're in our teens and our 20s, music becomes that soundtrack of our own sort of becoming an individual, separating from our parents. And so, you know, there can be a whole host of reasons why we love that music at that age. It could just because it's sort of different from what our parents loved. And obviously as we get more sophisticated, more older, we hear more sounds and think differently. The music that we loved when we were 16, it still probably has a level of nostalgia, but it may not be what we want to put on in those moments of, you know, sort of deep listening. But sometimes those pieces of music sort of stay with us our entire lives. You think of the stories of, you know, older people that are having some memory issues, even Alzheimer's. That music, you know, those Frank Sinatra songs that they loved when they were in their 20s, those come back in vivid ways, even if all other memories are lost. So, but one thing I guess I'd say that I try to get in the book is that our ability to continue to discover music that's familiar to what we've known in the past, but also different, it never ends. And so it really is incumbent on us to do the work, to not close our minds, but to keep discovering, because the benefits from pure enjoyment to even, you know, better health are there if we take our listening seriously.
Can we explore that a little bit more as far as what it means for us to do our work and to take that seriously and how we do that?
Well, you know, we're in such an amazing time, you know, through services like Pandora, but also, you know, Spotify and Apple. I mean, we can, start with something that we know that we love, and we can just get recommended other music that is similar but, you know, unfamiliar or maybe even not so similar. So that's kind of an easy way, is just to let these services and other recommendation sources help us. But I think really the deepest way to do that, and obviously that's why the book is so big, is because music is a rich topic. Just from a purely musicological, those musical elements of harmony and rhythm and instrumentation and sound, the more that we can understand what's going on in the music that we love. So let's say that there is, you know, that we happen to love songs that involve multiple voices happening at the same time in counterpoint. Okay, so that we can say, okay, well, counterpoint, I love counterpoint in this Beatles song or whatever. What other music that I'm not familiar with uses counterpoint? And so you can do some research. You can look in my books. I talk about it quite a bit. And start, you know, listening to music, whether it's Vivaldi or Bach or some Dixieland jazz or other music that, you know, that uses that kind of technique, and say, okay, let me follow that musical narrative. Let me follow what's going on, so I can get something out of this music that I might not have thought about previously. So, like in anything else, it's a matter of, you know, it's like discovering, you know, sort of good wine or something. You know, you have to kind of, you know, do some testing and experimentation. But there is, you know, there's so much amazing music out there, and we're so blessed that with a click of a button, a click of a mouse, we can listen to music written at any century and really any part of the country or any part of the world. And we never know when a hit song for us is going to be, you know, in our next click. So I think, you know, that's, you know, sort of a general way that we can, you know, take it into our own hands.
When you talk to people about their playlists and what they like, they will often say, you know, it's very schizophrenic. You'll find rap, you'll find classical, you'll find jazz, you'll find pop. And do you think, first of all, is that becoming more common, or has that always been the way, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's becoming more so, partly because we have such easy access to every style of music, and through media, whether it's social or public media, we can hear a hip hop song in a commercial next to a classical type thing, or obviously more sophisticated, you know, complex dissonant music in a movie. Our ears are again being incultured. Just by being a citizen of this country, for example, to such a huge breadth. You know, back in the 1960s, in 50s and 60s, cultural sociologists, people that were focusing on music but other things, you know, tried to put a little bit more of a box around people's taste. That if you had a lot of cultural capital, so to speak, so if you came from money and you had a high education, you were more likely to love classical music but not love, you know, pop or jazz. But of course, as you know, time goes on, and even in the research through the 1980s, that sort of notion of a limited connection between our background and our taste began to be challenged. And the notion of the omnivore came up in the 1980s. The notion that the more your average person, especially with some level of education, you know, may love classical, but they also loved rock and maybe even hip hop. And again, now I think that, you know, it's sort of anything goes in terms of style, but it's not to say that we all love everything. So this notion of an omnivore doesn't mean that you love everything, because that's certainly not the case. There's going to be certain styles, certain approaches, certain levels of sophistication, certain kinds of techniques. Even within a narrow realm of electronica or world music or soul and R&B, that we're going to love more than others. And so, I think that we are more open-minded than ever before, but, you know, it doesn't mean that we love everything.
And I don't want to leave out the fact, which you write a bit about, is music therapy and the therapeutic properties of sound, and specifically music.
Yeah, well, this really comes back to the notion of how hardwired we are for music, that we really it's in our makeup to not only perceive but to make sense of sound. That connection between music and emotion is deep-seated. Every time we hear a steady beat, it's directly in our cerebellum, is connected to our amygdala directly, so our sort of emotional center of the brain. So those kinds of neurotransmitters, those chemicals in our brain that can make us feel better, that can have an impact on our cardiovascular system, when we hear music, those are activated. And so, the literature is very rich, and now there's science around the fact that music can have this incredible effect on us. It can be as powerful as 10 milligrams of morphine for patients that are suffering, you know, from pain after surgery or through chemotherapy. So music therapy is really burgeoning. If people are listening in a critical and in a controlled kind of way, they can have that kind of sort of powerful effect. But it's not just when something goes wrong. For all of us, music has been directly associated empirically with our heightened sense of well-being, our subjective well-being, our ability to make better decisions based on sort of things that come at us. you know, music, if we're listening to music, it just opens up pathways in our brains that can allow us to sort of deal with the world in a better way, make us happier, and really make us healthier. And that's, you know, it's not just something that we think makes sense intuitively, but is actually borne out in science.
Well, the book is just marvelous and so fascinating. Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste. It's published by Flatiron Books. Nolan Gasser, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. Thank you.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Why You Like It, The Science and Culture of Musical Taste by Nolan Gasser. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.